I just like that you beat Dan Brown. I thought that was awesome.
You beat Dan Brown with a book on CSS transforms.
Yeah, for that's over awesome. The weekend. Yeah, I took a screenshot of it and I made a poster of it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Definitely. Like, get that laminated or something.
I had this poster from Apple when Apple made the Windows version of iTunes, and it was just a screenshot of iTunes, and the heading on the poster was "Hell just froze over," and that was it. And so I made a poster in a similar style, and it said, "Take that, Dan Brown," and it had a screenshot of our book ahead of Dan Brown. So just a little memento, you know. Awesome.
That's terrific. You got to keep those trophies.
Yeah, you know, it's nice. It's nice to have a remembrance, you know.
Yeah, especially after you put so much work into something. And
yeah, absolutely. I kind of have a bunch of like Apple related posters, and so that's kind of, you know, what made me think of it. Like, oh, I need a poster to commemorate this. It's a small poster. It's like 11 by 14. It's not like, you know, taking up the whole wall here, but you know, it's a poster nonetheless.
11 by 14 feet.
Yeah, exactly. but yeah, it is nice to have a reminder, you know. So yeah.
You know what you should do is you should mail one to Dan Brown.
I should do that. Syracuse is also, he's always on my mind. I've always got my eye on him. We were kind of like
your neck and neck.
Yeah, 1 and 2 for a while, 2 and 3. Today I'm down at number 7 and he's at number 2. So I don't know. Man. I'm going to have to like do the something.
The secret is that he just buys a lot of his own book.
Oh, that sounds like a good strategy.
Yeah. Just inside tip there, yeah.
Just take those marketing dollars and just buy books.
Right.
It is good because when you're number 1, they show a little screenshot of your cover in the top list. So it kind of like, you know, if people haven't seen it before, they see it then and, you know, kind of maybe are drawn to it if they haven't seen it already. So it is kind of good publicity to be number 1 in my category, that is computers and internet. So, So there's like the top list for the category, and then there's all top of all paid books. And so that's when all paid books was when
Dan Brown
was the list that I beat Dan Brown.
You took down Dan Brown. You can take down John Syracuse.
I hope so. That would be pretty cool.
So how'd you get into this, Vicky? What was your first sort of brush with computing?
Oh, that's a great question. So when I was in college, like many people, I couldn't really decide what I wanted to study. And, my dad works in IT. He currently works in the IT department at Detroit Edison, which is like the power utility company in the Detroit area where I'm from originally. So I was in school at the University of Michigan, and I think I was in either coming up on my second year or in my second year or something like that. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to study. And I was kind of taking some foreign language classes, and my dad was like, "You should take a programming class." And he's like, "Because you're good at, learning these other foreign languages. And it's sort of similar in a way when you're learning a programming language, you're learning, you know, a different way to express like
similar ideas, right?"
Exactly. So I did, and I kind of just stuck with it and graduated in computer science, and it was kind of an interesting time to be in computer science as a woman, because there were probably like 5 women total in the entire program.
Yeah.
Gotcha. But we're kind of like a science-y family. I have an older sister and she's a mechanical engineer. So we're kind of like a science-y family, as it is. But that is how I originally got into computing in the first place. The encouragement of a parent.
That's great. Yeah, it's the best way to do it. What was the hook for you? Did you like it? Was it web stuff at the time that hooked you, or was it even earlier? It was like native level Cursor.
Well, at the time, the language that we learned was C++. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing OS X for the first time in college in a friend's like room, you know, as you're in your college housing sort of situations.
Right.
Yeah. I remember so there wasn't really a lot of like, there was no iOS programming.
Right.
Cocoa programming was there for the Mac, but not like super popular. It definitely wasn't taught in school. So I think the first programming class was EECS 280, Electrical Engineering and Computer Science 280. There was EECS 100 and then there was EECS 280. And it was like writing a blackjack program in C++. So that was kind of the basis of a lot of our education. And there was
learning how to beat the odds at Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. And there was also a web design class, and I took that, or web programming, web design plus programming. It wasn't like, you know, super complicated web programming. It was actually the course that you could use to fulfill your English writing requirement. It was like technical communications 400 or something. And it was like a web class. Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was cool for, you know.
I mean, it's a bit weird, but I like the cross-discipline.
Yeah, it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And I ended up being the TA for that class for a year or so.
Oh, cool.
And then I had like a part-time job doing web stuff for the university. And that's kind of how it all started.
So as you get out of school, is that when you joined Apple immediately, or did you do other stuff first?
No, I graduated in 2001, and I was just telling a friend this story the other day, so it's kind of fresh in my memory. But I graduated in 2001, and it was the bubble had just kind of burst in 2000.
Yeah, it's an unlucky time for.
It was an unlucky time. we used to have this, you know, job fair type thing at school where all these companies would be coming and taking us to dinner and like, you know, all this stuff. And in those 2 years, the job fair changed from, you know, people really aggressively recruiting you to like, instead they wouldn't even like show up. Like their presence was like a table with a box on it for you to put your resume in. And that was like kind of it. So it was definitely a tough time to get a job.
Yeah. That's going to be heartbreaking after you.
It's a little tough. So I kind of stuck with my job that I had doing web stuff for the university for a while. And then, I had decided at some point that I wanted to work for Apple. And
what was the hook there? Just because you started to really enjoy an OS X, or it was becoming hip at the time, right? It was like all the web people started moving to the Mac because of the Unix underpinnings and stuff.
I honestly, like a lot of people that I knew started moving to the Mac because all of our projects had to be compiled on Unix for our classes. So we would have to go to these like Unix, I feel really old saying this, to go to these Unix workstations to compile our projects and, you know, write them and run them, whatever. And, and OS X being Unix based, you could have a Mac and not have to like go to this sad computer lab, you know, to work on your projects. Yeah. So that I think was a big draw for a lot of people that were in my program. And it was kind of a draw for me. And then I also just had a good friend who was like the Apple student campus rep at the time. And
which you would not believe how often those people come up.
Really?
Like, yeah. 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 Like, almost everybody that's worked at Apple has had some, we've discussed on this or talked to on the show.
Really?
Had a run in with a campus rep at some point. Yeah.
Had a run in with the campus
rep. Well, run in. Whatever.
We're still. Change
run in to be like a good experience, I should say.
Yeah. We're still actually good friends today. He worked for Apple for a time as well and lives out in the Bay Area now. So yeah, he was kind of like, I think you would do well at Apple, which is, I guess, the job of a campus rep is to like, I don't know, bring, not exactly bring people to Apple, but kind of like tell people what, you know, give more information, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So he kind of like planted the seed of me thinking about it. And then the more I kind of learned about Apple, I just thought it was a really cool company that I would definitely want to work for. So a friend of mine was working at Apple and he gave my resume to a recruiter there. And that recruiter called me and I had a bunch of phone interviews and then I had a bunch of in-person interviews. At the time, Apple was a lot smaller and this was also a secret project. And there was also, I think, a hiring freeze at the time. So I really had to interview with everyone on the team, plus like the VPs of the department. So that was a little stressful.
Yes, so, yeah. This was Safari that you got hired into?
That's right. Yeah.
What would become Safari, I guess. Yeah.
That's right. Yep.
So yeah, that's going to be a bit stressful because.
Well, of
who
course,
was
I
was VP at the time. Was it Forstall?
Forstall was there. I'm not sure if he was a VP at the time or a director, and Bertrand Serlet was also there.
Right.
So, but yeah, at the time,
it's a bit stressful coming out of the school, like your first job interviews with like, you know, big shots.
Yeah, it was a little stressful, but, you know, I had sort of like been through a ton of phone interviews already and I had come all this way, you know, from Michigan out to California. And I had been looking for a job for about a year, you know, and a lot of my friends went to this company that seemed kind of not very interesting. And so I was definitely kind of holding out for Apple and yeah, I knew that I really wanted the job. I like studied for the interview. I really like took it very seriously and it worked.
That's great. So what was the job exactly when you started out?
I was like probably like one of two QA people on the team. Okay. And we would always joke that like the other QA person took A through M. And I took N through Z for the entire internet, and you know, which is tough because W is in my half, and you know, W is a
wrong side of that deal.
Exactly, that's a lot of URLs. So that was my initial role on the team, which was great because you know. I never had an internship at Apple or anything like that. So it was a completely new experience for me. You know, also just moving to a new place, like being on this team where I didn't know a lot of people. It was like a really amazing experience, I have to say.
Yeah, that's great. Especially coming in while it's still being a secret project, must have sort of made you feel super special?
Yeah, I mean, I was excited about it for sure. But, you know, I think at the time, you know, I guess no one knew what Safari would become, you know? Mm-hmm. WebKit right. was also being invented at the time in conjunction with Safari. No one really knew what WebKit would become. So mm-hmm. it was exciting, but it wasn't, you know, overwhelming in the sense, you know, because we were kind of focused on the task at hand, which was getting the product out the door.
Yeah, that's good. I guess if you knew now what you knew then, it would be kind of crippling. Like, yeah. Oh my God, I don't want to screw this up.
It would be very paralyzing. So, but yeah, it was very cool.
So how long was that? Like a year and a bit, I guess, until Safari ships? Safari 1 ships 2003, right? Early 2000.
Yeah. And I started about halfway through 2002. So I was kind of in, I mean, it wasn't, you know, a 5-year project or anything like that. So it wasn't a super long project. It wasn't a year. I don't want to say the exact timeline because I'm not 100% sure of it. But I was there for the last 6 months until it was released in beta in January of 2003. You're right.
How was that? How was the launch day for your first product? I mean, you know, I got a major announcement.
It was good. It was very exciting. I know that Don wrote a blog post about it, about just like feeling paralyzed, yeah. watching Steve kind of just decide to start clicking around, like, just kind of just doing it, you know, and, so yeah, of course you don't want anything to go wrong and you're kind of holding your breath the whole time. It was definitely an experience.
Yeah. So eventually you moved into being the evangelist mm-hmm. or on the evangelism team. Is that soon after, or do you keep doing QA for a while or what?
I did QA for a while. Then I moved into fixing bugs in WebCore and WebKit. Then I worked on iPhone for a short time, and then I moved into evangelism.
Oh, I didn't know you. I didn't know you'd done the engineering for a bit.
Yeah, I did. I think that's kind of like a general flow for people, mm-hmm. or at the time it was at least, you know, starting in QA and moving into bug fixing and that sort of thing. I'm not sure if it's still exactly that way because things have grown so much, you know, now there's like a much larger, I would imagine a much larger QA group, et cetera. So I'm not sure if it.
Yeah. Still I've, works I've known a few people who've become a bit. Daniel Jelkett came through QA.
Oh, there you go.
Years ago though, like in late 90s.
Yep.
So did you enjoy the engineering side of it? Like what makes you get out of the engineering and sort of, I mean, evangelism still has engineering aspects to it. Like everybody mm-hmm. there is smart and knows what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I think it takes a certain kind of person to be a face on a very private company mm-hmm. and want to deal with people that can be kind of grumpy at times. Mm. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that is fair to say.
What sort of propelled you to get out of doing the engineering side of stuff and kind of sit in a seat that's kind of could be a little bit hotter because you're exposed to you know, you're exposed to the internal struggles and also to the
right
world, you know?
Well, it was, you know, I think it was just kind of an evolution of my career. So I had worked in engineering for about 5 years total at that point, both in Safari and iPhone. And
there'd been a lot of, I mean, that was a big 5 years worth of work there.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, it's sort of like once you're doing that for a while, at least personally, I was sort of like, well, what am I going to do next year? You know, and it's sort of right. like, you're becoming a manager or you keep doing what you're doing, right. you know, as an individual contributor, which is also fine. You know, both are really interesting career tracks to be on, I think. For myself, like I had always known John from the developers conference. I think I gave a few talks at WWDC, or I know I gave a few talks at WWDC before joining the evangelism team. So I had known John Galenci through through the conference, through speaking at the conference. And he's just, you know, half of a lot of being happy in your job is having a great manager. Mm-hmm. And I always liked working with John. I thought he would be a great manager. And then also the evangelism role, it's a role where you have a lot of responsibility, both externally and within the company as an influencer, mm-hmm. Without having direct reports as a manager. As a manager, I'm sure everyone who has ever been a manager realizes that you can spend a lot of time just kind of managing the logistics of your team and making sure everyone's right. happy and like managing the bug list and, you know, balancing the workload and that sort of stuff. So evangelism was kind of a way to take a step. I don't know. Some people would say up. I think it's kind of a step in some kind of direction that's not quite management. And you still get to be close to the technology, but have a lot more influence than you would as an individual contributor.
That's an interesting – it's like a step
diagonally
outwards kind of thing rather than –
Yeah. It's just a very unique position, you know, at Apple. I don't think there's any, I can't think of any other role like it, you know, in the entire company. So I sort of knew they were looking for someone. And so I applied.
Yeah. Well, you know, just getting back to Galenci, he's Canadian, so.
It's true. That's true. Is that a minus? It is kind of a minus.
I well, know. Hey, we're both Canadian, so.
Oh, then it's a plus. Then it's a plus.
This call's over.
Yeah, I understand. I understand.
So, did they have
Canadians.
A safari? Go ahead.
Canadians never let you forget it either, that they're Canadian.
I don't know. I just wanted to, because you said nice stuff about him, I just wanted to claim him as one of our.
Got it.
Did they have a safari evangelist at the time? It was a web technologies evangelist, right? That's the proper term?
Well, my job title was safari technologies evangelist. And there was another guy doing the job at the time. And the original intention was to split it between like mobile and desktop. And I don't even remember which one I was doing at first. I think it was that.
Was it at that WWDC that was like very bifurcated? It was almost entirely iOS style stuff?
No, I don't think so. I think that WWDC, if it was very separate, that was probably out of necessity because a lot of things were out of sync at the time. WebKit wise. But yeah, so there was another guy doing the role and the original intention was, I think, to split the role between desktop and mobile. But then, you know, Apple is a place where you're just always doing more with less. And so it quickly became like that this other person needed to work on something else. And then I kind of took over both platforms and that kind of made sense, you know, in a lot of ways. So
we talked to Mike Jurowicz and Matt Drantz previously. And they both said that team is very small for the amount of work that it has to do.
It is very small, but a lot of teams at Apple are like that. Mm-hmm. Kind of cuts down on the overhead, I think. Which is good. It's what has made Apple feel like a startup for so many years, even though it's a huge, massive company. So it's these small teams that just get a lot done. And I prefer to work that way even now. So,
How many WWDCs were you involved with?
I think 5. So because I joined the team at the end of 2007, well, There were a few that I were involved with before I moved to evangelism, but just as a speaker.
Yeah.
But then 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, and 2012, I guess. So five.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how much of the sort of the day-to-day of that group is wrapped up in doing the WWDC and the tech talks and all that?
Well, I mean, so if you work on a product, if you're on a software engineering team, you know, you have a product to deliver, you know, so you have that milestone, and it might be, you know, a few years ago, it would be Macworld in January and WWDC in the middle of the year. And those were kind of the two milestones. Now there's no more Macworld milestone. And, you know, there are, of course, other like product announcements throughout the year, et cetera. But if you're working on a product, you're aiming for 1.0, 1.2, you know, 2.0, 3.0, whatever. But for, I would say for the evangelism team, their primary product is the developers conference. So I think it is quite a bit of energy gets tied up in that conference. And I have to say, I think the conference is amazing.
Yeah.
So I've been to other conferences that have been very, very good. But I think it's very evident that a lot of work goes into WWDC. And I actually attended the conference this past year in 2013. So as an attendee, and I was like completely blown away. And that's kind of having seen how the sausage is made. I was completely blown away. I was like texting John saying the conference is so great. Great job. You know, it's a lot of work, but
yeah.
I think it shows. So
yeah, it's really, yeah. I guess it feels so relaxing, I suppose, when you don't have to be stressed every time you walk in and you want, you know,
yeah,
wondering what's going on in all the rooms and, you know, are the banners straight or whatever.
I mean, you're just running from place to place and like, you know, the people who are presenting, maybe they've done a talk before, but it's usually like a 50-50 split. Mm-hmm. They've maybe done a talk before and, or they have not. So people are really nervous. A lot of people are, you know, those guys are also, they've got their engineering deliverables for the product to worry about. So they may be behind on their presentation and you're there to really deliver every aspect of the conference. And if that means, you know, like making slides for someone or rehearsing extra times or writing a demo for them or getting on stage to perform a demo, et cetera.
Do whatever you can to make it work. Right?
Completely. Yeah.
Did you have a preference for when it was a big year for Safari, for example, like when the iPhone shipped or when you did plugins or when it was a major event, or did you prefer the years where it was just sort of incremental or and you could maybe relax more?
I like the years that were big years. Just having a lot to talk about, I think, is almost easier to plan because you're not like struggling to come up with session ideas, you know, out of kind of like recycling things you've already talked about or like, you know, trying to make a feature that's maybe a little obscure into an entire, you know, 60-minute session or 45 minutes. So I prefer the years where there's just a ton of stuff to talk about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we had some pretty amazing demos at different points in history. So that's probably my favorite is when there's a lot to talk about. And also I like giving a talk a lot of the time too. So that kind of adds to my like list of favorite years, you know, whether or not I gave a talk that I thought was well received or not. So yeah.
Presenting. Yeah, what do you like about talking? Because I kind of enjoy doing it, but, you know, I get all stressed out before, and I like to do it once a year or so just to to do it because it's a challenge. It's something new for me, and I, you know, I kind of want to force myself to do it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, but you enjoy it. What aspect of that is it? Does it go back to being the teacher TA kind of thing? Like, is that interesting?
Well,
for you?
I'm not sure. I do like the teaching aspect of it, but. First of all, I want to just say I still get very nervous before a talk. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that'll ever go away, but I've just kind of learned to like tune it out and just do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do like the teaching aspect. I think it's actually really challenging to put together a great presentation and one that, you know, I think you probably see a lot of presentations that aren't very engaging and might not be engaging, but I think one of the reasons is the speaker puts the focus on themselves. Like a very mm-hmm. common thing is to get up and say, well, my name is Vicky Murley. I worked at Apple for 10 years, and now I run this company, Sprightly Books, and I just put this book out, and it's so great. And, you know, I think subconsciously the listener in the audience is thinking, they're not thinking this directly, but it's sort of like, well, who cares? You know, like, why am I here? You know, I get it. You have to say something about why you're the expert in this field. But why am I here? You know, and that is the question that you have to kind of keep answering to the audience throughout the entire presentation, you know. So you might want to say like, you know, hi, I'm Vicky Murley, the Safari Technologies Evangelist at Apple. Okay, how many of you have ever had a video on a website or something like that? And that's, mm-hmm. you know, people attending that session are going to be like, me, I have.
Yeah, okay.
So, and then
present the problem and then present how to keep solving it, I suppose.
Exactly. And try to think of problems that the people in your audience have faced and, you know, and like I said, just continually reminding them, continually engaging them. Like maybe you've had this problem and, you know, you should be seeing these light bulbs go off behind people's eyes. Like, oh yeah, I have had that problem. I'm super interested now in how to fix that. So I think that's like the biggest challenge about making a great presentation. And, I think that's one reason that the talks at the developers conference are so great because they kind of like maintain that focus from the start and throughout and then at the end, you know. And then there's all other, you know, a zillion other things that you have to think about for a great presentation. So I think I just like the challenge of it. And I do like the teaching aspect of it a lot as well. And
so go ahead. I kind of set you up for this, and I'm glad that you gave that awesome answer because over the weekend I watched you speak at W3Conf on YouTube,
yeah.
And your talk follows exactly that pattern.
Oh, and
more. I don't know if you've watched it because it's hard to go watch yourself. But they do this thing where they overlay tweets that are happening in real time on the bottom of the video. And all of them are saying exactly what you just said that you want people to see, like to be thinking. Like, oh my God, it's the desktop versus mobile web development one that you gave 10 days after leaving Apple, like earlier this year. Mm-hmm. So everybody should go watch that, including you, Vicky.
Okay, yeah.
It'll be in the show notes.
So it's actually pretty good.
Go ahead.
Sorry to cut you off. It's just interesting to see the tweets come in, and they're actually just totally reaffirming what you've just been explaining. So. Good
I'll
job.
Have to watch it. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, maybe you can mute it and cover up your bit if you don't want to see yourself do it and just read the tweets or something.
Yeah, yeah. And also I think that, you know, the talks at the developers conference, they follow like, they don't follow a format, but they're very like problem based. Like you're trying to solve this problem and that kind of gives it a format. Whereas like talks, I think talks at other conferences are like, they don't necessarily follow that format. Like sometimes they're just like, look at this cool thing you can do just for the heck of it, you know, which is also really interesting. But I was nervous during that talk because I was like, oh, I'm used to doing this like other format of talks and that sort of thing. As I stated earlier, I still get nervous a lot. So.
Well, you did.
But it was nice. It was well received. People liked it. So that was good.
So what led to you deciding to leave Apple?
Another great question. Well, I had worked there for more than 10 years and I had really accomplished, I felt like I had really accomplished a lot. Mm-hmm.
Well, 5 years in QA and engineering leading up to getting iPhone out the door. That's quite a bit there. And five years evangelizing the platform to the point that it's pretty much king of the hill, especially WebKit. If you take WebKit as the thing, it's like, you know.
Yeah.
So just time to try something new, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, also, you know, I was commuting from San Francisco for 10 years. So there were probably some like, you know, logistical things that I was just
people
like,
don't know that's what, like it's an hour and 20 minute sort of trip.
It's about an hour because I live on the south side of the city. So it was about an hour.
It's a hassle. So, 10 years, 2 hours traveling.
Well, yeah, but that's not like the main reason. That's like the, you know, 10th reason that just like,
You know what I'm projecting? Because I work at home and I can't imagine traveling anymore.
It's tough. So I had worked there for 10 years and I was kind of like, well, what are the next 5 years going to be like here? You know, and I had already held 3 different positions at the company, like Safari, iPhone, and then evangelism. And, so that's like, you know, that's really cool. I don't know. I just felt like I didn't know. How can I say this describe this exactly? I guess, yeah, the simplest thing was I just felt like it was time to try something else, you know? I mean, I think I could have stayed at Apple for, 20 or 30 years. But I had started at Apple just out of college too. Mm-hmm. And so this was really like the only company I had ever worked for, you know, which is great. I'm not like, it's, if you're going to work for one company, Apple is the one that you want to work for. But also the world had changed a lot in the time that I was there just because of iOS coming out in the App Store, you know?
Oh yeah. Biggest 10 years of change since the 80s, I'd guess.
Yeah. So when I started at Apple, like if you were in computing and looking for a job and you wanted to make software that people used, you know, that lots of people used, you were going to work at like Apple, Microsoft, or Adobe, you know?
Yeah.
And now you can, you know.
Yeah, Google didn't even exist. Yeah.
Yeah. Or they did, actually. I think they did.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was 98 or something. But they weren't the same sort of.
They were a search input field.
Exactly.
Well, they weren't the Goliath that they are today, right? Yeah.
That's true. So, you know, the world has changed a lot. Now we're in a world where you can just kind of go and make your own way and like do your own thing and, you know, be an entrepreneur. And I was kind of interested in being an entrepreneur for a long time. And I'm kind of like a self-starter kind of person. So I'd been thinking about that for a while. And then I probably thought about the decision to leave generally for about 2 years and then seriously for like a year. I thought about it. So wait,
that, doing the math, that you literally got a 7-year itch.
I did. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's a little crazy because like so many of my friends are there, like people who I've known for a really long time who are just really near and dear to me. It was really hard to tell them that I was leaving the company. So it was a very hard decision, but ultimately I just wanted to try something else, you know? So
Spritely Books, why books? Well, I should say they're iBooks author and EPUB books, right? So it's definitely in your wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Making EPUBs is a serious pain in the ass.
That can be true.
I've spoken to. So I think that it's
not that bad. It's,
well, not for you, because you know what you're doing. That's true. Can you examine that a bit more? Like, why did you choose to go into like that specific kind of thing?
Well, so, you know, even though I didn't have a lot of job experience as a web developer before I came to Apple, I really developed a lot of expertise in that area, throughout my time at Apple. And
you could not, at that point.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's one of the great things about Apple is like, you're just constantly learning and you get to learn from the people who invented the technology, I did a few talks at WWDC that were on HTML5 video. And if I had a question about it, I could just go talk to the engineer who implemented it, and that is very, very powerful. Like I've almost forgotten what it's like to be kind of like muddling around for an answer to some kind of unexpected behavior. Mm-hmm. So you learn so much so quickly, just because you have access to all of these amazing resources. I really developed a lot of expertise in that area, but I didn't necessarily want to make websites. And the book platform for Apple was gaining ground a little bit. We had done a few talks at WWDC on iBooks and how to make books for iBooks. And they were very well received. And they were really interesting to me. So I kind of started thinking about it as an interesting platform to which I could apply my expertise. And also, there just aren't a lot of really super great ebooks out there. And granted, I haven't seen all of them, but from the ones I've seen, I haven't been completely blown away.
Do you think a lot of that is because of the variety of readers and how sort of fractured the platform is? Like an original Kindle can't render anything that like an iPad can render, right?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's because there are a lot of publishers that have been around for, 100 years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's difficult to know the entire breadth of what's possible. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's been a little tough. We're just now kind of entering this stage where a lot of physical bookstores have closed, which I think is actually kind of sad because mm-hmm. it's always nice to go to a bookstore.
My first job was at a bookstore. So
I had a job at a bookstore too when I was in high school or something.
Yeah, exactly. Same with me.
A lot of these big companies, they're kind of slow to change and adapt. And then, they don't really, I think things are changing, but many of them at the time, or even now, don't have the in-house technical expertise to execute something that's very different from what they're currently doing.
They're printing their books in iBooks format. They're not really taking advantage of what an iBook is, almost like when they used to film stage plays instead of learning how to cut movies.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I think in the app world, people have realized that if you are going to make an app that's sort of like a real world object, you need to make it better than the real world object. And I think the same is true for a book. And like you said, what we've seen a lot of is just a direct transfer, you know, like scanning a PDF into that ebook form. And that's like a lot of what is out there, but there's so much more that you could do. So also the format of a book is really appealing to me, having kind of a teaching and instructional background. A book has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So even if I wanted to make a website on CSS transforms, I wouldn't be able to, I guess you can guide a person through a website, but there's just something about a book that lets you.
Well, so like a website has a very random access, or you need to support exactly. random access. Like I need to look up how to do Y. Yeah. Rather than a book, which can present a narrative to sort of explain the concept to you.
Exactly. It's not like people aren't going to skip around if they need to, but like sure. in general, they're going to go from the beginning, middle, and end. And even just by nature of being a book, it's like, I think it's something that people kind of mentally are like, oh, I'm setting aside some time to go through this and like learn something, as opposed to, like you said, just, you know, Googling your question and clicking around on the links that come up to find the answer, et cetera. So, so that format really, you know, the technical part of it appealed to me, and the format also appealed to me a lot. And then I just felt like I could make something really cool.
And you have, as we said at the top, it's been doing really well. So that's great. We should get rid of that Syracuse guy. Besides that, I know.
What's up with that?
One of the things I thought was really interesting is right in the beginning of the book, when you go over the history of CSS transforms, you mention Steve Jobs's letter on Flash. And we had Jonathan Deutsch on the show last time, and he mentioned that, you know, when he read that letter, it sort of made him realize internally that Hype, his eventual indie application, would be necessary. And it's sort of, that letter seems to have been pivotal to so many advances in web technology. I sort of said, you know, it's not going to be on the iPhone. You've got to go forward. And that allowed, I don't know if it's fair to say that, but it seemed to make people take CSS far more seriously than they might otherwise if they could have just ridden Adobe forever.
You know, I think, so when that letter was published, I was on the evangelism team as the Safari evangelist, and
got a few emails.
Well, in the time before that letter, it was really hard to convince people that they needed to adopt an alternative to Flash, you know, and that it was like, it wasn't impossible, but it was near impossible, you know, like you have a huge media company and all of your video is in Flash, you know. And this iPhone thing is out, and, you know, your site doesn't work right now, but you know, the user base is growing. A lot of people really like iPhones, but it's not quite where it is currently. And it's going to be a lot of work for you to like change over all this video, you know, to HTML5 video. I mean, I know my book is on CSS transforms, but the video thing is a huge part of it. Yeah. And, you know, and you've got Adobe saying, oh, we're working on it, you know, which they were, you know, and they're publicly saying, yeah, we're working on it. We've got this thing coming. Flash for iOS. Yeah. We're working on it. You know?
I didn't get the sense that Adobe was being disingenuous with that. I think they were being very helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they were working on it, but, you know,
it just wasn't working. Yeah.
Apple had the final say as to whether or not it would be there. And that I think was lost on a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Having Steve come out and be like, nope, it's never happening. that was so helpful because then people were like, oh, okay, yeah, well, we better start on this then, you know.
Well, one thing that Steve said in that note, I guess, blog post, was that like so many crashes from Safari came from Flash.
Yeah.
And I know that from, I don't want to name them, but other people that shipped WebKit components in it. And like if you turned on Flash in them, sure enough, they just end up with like a huge amount of their bug reports or crash logs just containing like a Flash stack trace for no apparent reason. It's like not in their code. Flash just blew up on them. And then, you know, the customer gets pissed off. And that, you know, that got it's addressed a little bit better now with WebKit too, but Flash was flaky on the Mac, let alone like letting it anywhere near iOS.
Also, the experience wasn't great on mobile platforms. So.
No, I don't think how it could be. I mean, so much of that just relies like, well, Hover Over is like key to most of that garbage. Now, sorry, I say garbage just because I don't like the UI standard or the UI interaction model, but. Yeah, it just, I couldn't see it being supported.
Yeah. So yeah, now there's kind of new and interesting ways to deliver video and deliver all kinds of cool effects, I think. It's pretty cool that Apple was kind of at the forefront of that too. And I feel like the timing, I kind of feel like I'm always in the right place at the right time. And I feel like, this is another instance where I was in the right place at the right time, like talking to the people who invented all this stuff. It was pretty cool.
And you include the letter in the beginning of the book from David Hyatt and company to the Worldwide. Is it a consortium or committee? I forget the acronym.
Consortium.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I figured if I were reading this book, I would want to see that. And it's just a link on a public mailing list, you know, website. So anyone could just follow that link and see it in the W3C email archives. But it's always nice. I don't like a lot of links that take you out of the book. So, so we put it in the book.
Well, it's nice because Apple really does have that, you know, a guy mentioned that reputation for being private, but on the other hand, WebKit is a huge open project, and this was this was basically you guys sharing, or you guys at the time sharing, what was going to be really important CSS technology basically with the whole world.
Yeah, definitely. I think I kind of enjoyed, or I mean, I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but I kind of thought it was important to put that in there as well, because I think Apple gets a little, it's not so much this way currently, but maybe a few years ago, Apple was kind of getting a bad rap as being like uncooperative in the web space and not caring about the web and that sort of thing. When really, you know, it was people at Apple who kind of invented a lot of these technologies. So, or, you know, it was an Apple platform that had a certain technology first. It's just, you know, Apple isn't very vocal about that sort of thing. So
the CSS transforms came from basically the core animation stuff, right?
Yeah.
And the and Canvas came from pretty much just exposing the Quartz imaging model.
Yeah. And so, Canvas was originally needed for dashboard widgets, so that's kind of how that started. The flight tracker path.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Do you know what I don't know anything about? Web technologies. I know just enough to be dangerous. But yeah, I don't know. Like I'm in like a native client side kind of guy. So I've been trying to read up and watch as many videos this past weekend so that I could actually talk sense with you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, no, thank you for giving me an excuse to actually start learning about all of this stuff. Because a lot of it's familiar. In that it has sort of existed on Apple platforms before, but the way you express it over the web is very different. Like the, you know, all the CSS stuff, and it's got a very declarative sort of approach rather than, you know, writing code. So it's interesting. I'm slowly learning.
I think I actually really like web technologies because they're such a great, you can, they're so great for people who are just getting into programming. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's a lot of talk lately about kids getting into programming and how to teach them, and yeah. women getting into computing and how to teach them. And HTML, you can just, all you need is like a text editor and a web browser. Everyone has it, you know, and you can just like write a little bit and get something pretty cool on screen, you know, like you can get a box on screen pretty quickly, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's sort of this like high reward with not that much effort. So you feel like you're making progress. And I think that's really important when you're learning something new that could be potentially intimidating, like programming.
Yeah.
So, and then as you progress, a lot of those concepts that you learn, you know, in JavaScript or whatever can be applied, to other, you know, programming languages, you know, like event listeners in JavaScript. Mm-hmm. There's a very, very similar, programming paradigm in iOS programming. So it's kind of cool that you can start with like almost nothing and get something going pretty quickly and then apply what you're learning to other platforms as well. So,
yeah, like when I started, I started with BASIC. And, you know, you could type a program and everything was command line style then. So it would look vaguely like what professional apps would look like. You know what I mean? You could kind of fake it in a way. But, you know, these days getting anything native to look anywhere near anything professional is basically impossible. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I do totally agree with you. The especially when you're just learning, you need that sort of fast endorphin rush of like tweaking something and seeing something change.
Yeah.
And there's nothing faster than just hitting reload in a web browser.
Yeah, totally. That's, I don't know. I think about that a lot, like why web technologies are appealing. And I think that's why.
Yeah.
Or why would I, you know, why not write a book on iOS programming or something? And of course, some of it has to do with my expertise, but you know, it also has to do with just, I don't know, like working with people who are more on the beginner side as opposed to the, you know, professional shipping, professional apps kind of level.
It's also very popular. I mean, like you can write one of these web applications that'll, or even web pages or books, and people, regardless of platform, can use it and benefit from it. It's got an incredibly vast footprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to think so. Also, you know, it's a very visual medium. So I feel like I'm hearing about kind of more and more people who are strictly designers who are dabbling in HTML and CSS. To kind of create a prototype or whatever. And I think that's also really interesting. You know, it just sort of shows like how much our world is changing that, you know, now it used to be, you know, a paintbrush or whatever for a designer to use as their tool. And, you know, a lot of them are now kind of dabbling in HTML and CSS a little bit too, which I think is really cool.
We have to design interaction now, not just interface.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They better learn some JavaScript too.
Which is nice because in the book too, you touch on the importance of performance, because when you go from desktop to mobile, you have so many more constraints and so many more limitations, and it really starts to matter again, not just what you do, but how well you do it.
I think that's completely true. And, you know, I think I said something similar in the book, and it's just along the lines of we're so used to using these mobile devices and they seem so powerful, you know, and they are, but they're not, they're still not as powerful as your desktop machine. So, so you do need to think about performance and, you know, memory and everything. So.
And the CSS transforms, you said, were a lot smarter way of doing things than, for example, just moving them using coordinate systems.
Right. Because if you animate something using the transform property to like translate X or translate Y, for example, it won't trigger a repaint. And so, so that is a huge performance gain right there. not having to repaint is going to give you lots and lots of smooth animations. So something everyone needs to know. I think the word is getting out for sure. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people have been kind of talking about this lately. So,
well, I've seen a lot of cool stuff done with CSS transforms. I think the first one must have been the cover flow effect that you guys did.
Oh.
I think.
Yeah. That's a pretty cool one. I think that's pretty cool. That took a lot of effort to get exactly right.
I was really surprised when I saw it working. I mean, not to take away from the team or anything, but that was pretty cool to see in a web browser.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is pretty cool. there's a lot of, from what I hear, there's a lot of like very small details involved in the cover flow animation to get it exactly right. So to make a, I think other people on the web had tried to make a cover flow control, you know, in HTML and CSS, but of course they didn't have access to, you know, all the different little pieces of math that get it just right. The one we did was pretty cool.
So what's next for you?
Well, I'm kind of trying to, well, let me start over. So what's next for me? Well, I'm looking for new authors for my company to make even more cool and interesting books. I'll probably write another book because it's just a great feeling to work on something, love how it turns out, and then have other people love it as well. Mm-hmm. So having my book be, my first book be so well received has definitely made me want to do another one. I'm kind of continuing to, you know, make beautiful, amazing things is kind of my goal for the next 6 months or so at least. So
that's great. Yeah. Do you want to leak a topic?
Just
say no.
No,
no spoilers.
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. I was actually setting you up to say no. So.
Oh, okay. Cool. I have an idea, but I don't even have like a cover for it yet. I can't be 100% sure, but I definitely have some ideas.
Is there anything you're looking forward to in the future of web tech? Like, what makes you excited about what's coming next in web technology? Is it stuff like WebGL? Is it just more of what we have now?
I think WebGL is really interesting and cool. I remember doing some OpenGL programming projects when I was in college, and that's probably the last time I touched OpenGL. So WebGL, I think it'll be interesting if someone makes like a really cool tool that enables you to do a lot of cool stuff with WebGL. Maybe there's one already out there. I'm not really sure. I think WebGL could be pretty cool. I mean, it's like anything though, used in the right way. A lot of the time you have like some kind of animation that's just there for the sake of it. And it's not actually useful. Yeah.
Under construction.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, if people use it in a way, it's just essential to have a great designer all the time, I think. So if people use it in the right way, it'll be pretty cool, I think. And you know, there are other improvements coming to existing technologies, so those will be interesting to see as well, kind of, you know, seeing how the technologies we currently have get developed even more, I think is always interesting.
There's a weird tension though between like consortiums and standards committees make things slow, but they also make them compatible. So sometimes you want things to go faster, but you don't want them to break.
I think that they can, they're moving along at an okay pace, I think. And browsers have to implement things in order to get that final ratification of a standard anyway. So I think overall I'm pretty okay with the pace at which things are going. That said, you know, a lot of the time I get to work just in WebKit. So, you know, I'm not in the position of being a website developer where I have to worry about, you know, 10 different versions of 4 different browsers and that sort of thing. So
you run the nightly build still?
Yeah, I do, because sometimes I run into a bug and I want to see if it's fixed. So I definitely run the nightly builds. I don't build them myself or anything like that, but I always download them. So I feel like if I submit a bug and I'm not using a nightly build, all my old coworkers are going to be like, what are you thinking? Why haven't you tried a nightly build? So yeah, of course. And also, you know, this past year, the nightly builds had an updated version of the Web Inspector in it, which then shipped in Mavericks and in the newest version of Safari in general. And the new tools, I think, are amazing.
They're fantastic.
So, yeah. Going back to the old ones feels painful at this point. So it's always good to, I always like having the nightly builds because it's sort of like you get a little preview of what is coming up. So
like living slightly in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. I feel like I should ask you guys questions about yourselves.
Don't worry about it. People, please, yeah, nobody comes here to listen to us.
Oh, okay.
So, everybody should go out and buy CSS Transforms?
Yeah.
Yeah. CSS Transforms, an interactive guide is the title of the book. Perfect. Or you can just search by my name. That'll bring it up too.
It'll be right in the show notes. It's very conveniently.
Okay. So you got a good link to it?
Yep.
Perfect. So your job as a listener is to knock Syracuse out of the rankings by buying Vicky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Screw that
Syracuse. Yeah. I'm like always looking at his name every morning. And then there's like a few books about Evernote stuff that are really popular too.
Forget them.
Yeah. Come on, guys. You know?
Do you want to read about someone else's product or do you want to make your own?
Exactly. That's a great tagline.
Yeah. I love that because my background was I wrote my first website in, this is going to sound funny, with Notepad and Fractal Design Painter. And I don't even want to think about how long ago that was. And I've always loved this stuff. And the minute I saw, I forget who tweeted about the book, but it might have been Melton. I don't remember. But the minute I saw it, I had to buy it. And, you know, the Matrix stuff is a bit beyond me, but the other stuff I thought hugely educational. And you know, if more people buy it, I'll just get better websites. So it's kind of a purely selfish act.
Awesome. That's awesome. I love hearing, you know, that's kind of like what my evangelism role was about a lot of the time was like trying to get people to make better websites. So it makes me feel so good to hear you say that because I feel like I'm kind of like, you know, continuing
in the tradition.
Yeah. Continuing the tradition. And I really, you know, would like people to make better websites.
And I swear now, if any of our tech team ever makes, you know, a website redraw, I'm just going to say, why didn't you use a transform? I told you to buy this book.
Exactly. And, you know, web technologies, they're sort of in a lot of places these days, not just on the internet. Yeah. So it kind of applies to a lot of different places, which I think is, again, a super cool thing about web technologies. So
ubiquitous.
Yeah, I'm not exactly like, oh, the web is going to take over the world. But, you know, I do think that they're accessible. You know, a lot of, like I said before, you can get started doing a lot with just a little bit. And you know, they are ubiquitous. So I think those are some cool qualities.
I will say they get more sane every time I look at them.
More what? Like
they're becoming more sane every time I look at them.
Oh.
Like the column stuff seems great. The region stuff seems great. Pagination stuff in iOS 7 seems great. It's just, like every time I'd go to make a website, I'd get, yes, Flexbox.
Flexbox, awesome. Yep, that's great. Yep.
Yeah. I mean,
the calc function, that's also going to be really great is really great.
What does that do?
I actually haven't really used it that much myself, but you can use it to like calculate different values on the fly.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Safari cool. and Mavericks is so good.
I think so too. Yeah. I think they did an awesome, awesome job.
Yeah. Rock solid. Very,
yeah, I agree. Awesome. I think I'm biased, so it's nice to hear you say that.
So, yeah. And I'll take this out of the show, but I run Chrome for when I have to use Flash and to sort of jail Gmail. And that's everything else is in Safari. So when Safari is that solid, it just makes my life easier because our backend is Drupal and Drupal is like a battleship. And when you can keep that running, you're doing a good job.
Awesome. That's awesome. I'm glad to hear that. I love Safari. I have like super soft spot in my heart for Safari, of course. So
Vicky, where can we, if people are, and people should be interested, but when people are interested in where they can find out more about you and more about your work, where can they go?
That's the right question. Well, I'm on Twitter. My handle is just my full name, all lowercase, Vicky Murley. And the book has a website, csstransforms.com. So any new information about the book will be posted there. And then
I can't
my company,
believe you got that. Sorry to interrupt you.
I know.
But I can't believe you got that domain name.
You know what? I feel bad almost because like.
No, whatever. Now you're the definitive answer.
Exactly. So I also have csstransformsbook.com, but the website is actually at csstransforms.com because I was like, what? I can't believe this. And then I of course got like, you know, full hosting on that URL before I thought of csstransformsbook.com.
No, you're canonical now.
Yeah, it's crazy. Isn't that crazy? So many people were like, I can't believe you got that domain.
Oh, I hadn't seen this before. You got a quote from Milton up there.
Yeah, absolutely. He's really funny. He's a great guy. You guys
We had him and Drance on the phone last week.
Oh.
And given all that brain power, we just talked about RoboCop for like an hour and a half.
Nice.
What a waste of like smart people to talk to. But we had a lot of fun. So.
I mean, you know, Don basically like changed my life. You know, Don hired me at Apple and like plucked me from the hills of Michigan, you know, and dropped me down in Silicon Valley. And, you know, I'm like, Don is a great guy. I mean, I'm not just saying that because he, you know, like I said, changed my life, hired me, whatever. But I think it's only now that I've been working for a long time that I realized what a great manager Don was on the Safari project. He's just like an insanely, insanely good manager, in my opinion.
But even on a podcast, a man has zero regression. It's ridiculous.
I believe it.
We're going to have to cut all this stuff out. I don't want him hearing this. It's just going to go to his head.
I mean, even the, you know, this is like self-serving because I'm one of the people that Don hired, but like the team of people that he assembled for the Safari project was like incredible. I mean, you know, Darren Adler knows more about making software than any person I've ever met in my entire life. You know, Ken Kashenda is like, he's always inventing something new and like getting things done that
he wrote the keyboard, literally.
Exactly. Exactly. And there are, you know, other people on that team as well that are just, you know, the inventor of WebKit, Richard Williamson, you know, he was on that team. So
it's a dream team, a bit of a dream team.
Yeah, and Don assembled it. So he's like an amazing manager. And
I'll keep a bit of that in just so that I can diffuse the anger his puppy keeps putting in him.
Oh, okay.